This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
Nobody who advocates for change is able to be effective without experience. Going through your suffering and having definitive proof that there must be a better way. Knowing that somewhere down the line, the generational curse must be broken. Mired in your own mental prison has you bear witness to all sorts of ugliness. Feeling the desire to shift the paradigm, you make the first move. Once you break the shackles and run far enough away, you hope to return and free the other prisoners. On the other side of a bad situation, it looks much different. To walk out and never go back for the others would selfishly be a waste of your training. Once you make it out of the valley, make sure you lend a hand to lift the next one up to your level. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and welcome to the Suffering Podcast. If you're a fan of overcoming adversity and overcoming suffering, then we're for you, because that's what we do here and that's the stories that we highlight. So do me a favor, hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, please comment, ring the bell so you can get notified of all of our new content. Now you can join. Follow us on all social media so you can find out what we're up to. On this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we welcome Danny Bookum Rivera. I love that name, man. Thank you, man. That's a great nickname.
Bookum, Dan, I'll murder one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thankfully you became a cop, so the nickname fits.
It worked out.
It worked out well.
Yep.
To talk about the suffering of a mentor, because Danny is now pulling others up from the area that he came from, and that's very important. We always light the torch for the next group of people. Mm-hmm. Before we get into anything, let's throw a big shout out to our marquee sponsor. That's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as police officers, but we do trust them. So go to ToyotaHackensack.com and let them find you a car. I was just there on Saturday. They're a bunch of good guys over there. So this
my father's car is still going.
It's still for now, yeah, until he backs into something. Yeah. So Danny, each week we take a question from our audience. This week's question comes from user 152426. I guess they didn't create a real profile. What is a generational curse that you have broken with your children? You're our guest. I want to let this one go to you, because not all the way you were raised was bad, but not all of it was good either.
Exactly. Yeah. Great question, user. But what I want to say is love. Very basic. Growing up, you know, I had an absentee father who wasn't there. Was lacking love. My mother was a loving mother in the way where she would work and bring home the bread. But I was lacking love. You know, nobody at my games, nobody there. And I always tell the kids that I work with, I say, "How do you spell love?" It's T-I-M-E. Because time,
yeah.
You give whatever you love your time. So I didn't have that time and that love. So what I do is I just make sure that I spend time, quality time with my daughters. I have three daughters.
Being present, not on your phone.
That's
a big thing.
Not just showing up to a game or something.
Yes.
Actually paying attention to the game.
Exactly. My daughters are into dance competition. So, you know, I'm there cheering them on. I want them to visibly see me, that I'm actively cheering them, whatever they decide to do, as long as it's positive. And I just think that's a generational curse that, you know, by the grace of God, I've been able to break.
But, you know, time is that one thing. That is the most valuable asset we have. And 1 year, and I think I said this before on the show, 1 year, I didn't have a whole lot of money. I was a brand new cop, I think. And I made everybody, like I used to do a lot of woodworking and stuff. I made everybody Christmas presents. And I spent a lot of time on this. And I gave it to somebody and I watched their face and I said, well, I made this with my time. My time is the most valuable thing. And this guy says to me, he goes, well, money's the most valuable thing to me. And I said, then you're poor. That's what I said. You're as poor as can be.
Great answer.
Mike, what do you think?
You know, I mean, my childhood, you know, you've met my father. My father was there for everything for me. My father didn't miss one of my sporting events until I got to college.
So, tread carefully, because this man's going to give you a smack and me a smack. Tread carefully.
Why do you think I'm diverting from this question? No, I mean, he wasn't there every day. You know, my parents were divorced when I was young. He was there every day. But I do have a friend whose father was very abusive when he was younger. And now my friend has three kids, and they are the absolute love of his life.
So is this really the same friend that I know?
Yeah. He broke that generational curse. He's involved in everything his kids do.
Now, do you think moving down the line, since he was able to break that generational curse, do you think there's a possibility that his children could fall back
into that generation? Because it's like a virus, you know? It might skip a generation.
Well, yeah. I don't know, but his kids are such well-rounded, respectful kids. You know, I couldn't see them going that way.
Yeah, I met one of them. You're absolutely right on that one.
Yep.
You know, for me, I grew up in a very repressive, emotionally absent household. And I was struck frequently. There was times I went to bed, you know, tears in my eyes, hurting, but it toughened me up over time to the point where that didn't hurt, but the emotional abuse actually hurt worse. And that's something I try to break with my children. So my kids are getting bigger now, so I don't think hitting them would do any good.
They may hit back.
Yeah. Well, my oldest is now taller than me at 14. So yeah, that's going to end up bad someday, but I've never struck them. Never, even when they were little, I never laid a hand on them. I was able to give them a look and calm them down because I think about the generational curse that I had. I was struck and it didn't do any good. It actually made me worse because I always said, if I'm going to get punished for something,
I'm going to do it. Exactly.
Make it worth it. Yep.
Yeah.
If I get accused of something, yeah, I'm going to do it.
I'm going to make sure I earn it. And I've never laid a hand on them and I never will lay a hand on them because it does nothing but builds up their aggression, builds up their fear. Kids shouldn't be afraid of you. They should be leery of you. Don't get me wrong. There's times when you need to assert your alpha attitude in front of them. But for the most part, they should be respectful.
Let them know who's boss.
Yeah, you got to let them know who's boss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's the same thing in law enforcement too.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
You don't have to be an idiot. You just, you know, let them know that you're in charge and...
Well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing with a dog. Like you beat a dog too much, that dog is going to have some serious behavioral problems. And the minute that dog sees weakness,
yeah,
that dog's going to bite. But if you treat a dog with love firmly, let that dog know you're the boss.
You're the alpha. Yep.
And that dog will do whatever you say. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a nice little barometer on how I like to raise my kids. Not treating them like dogs. Don't get me wrong.
Well, I mean, they do sleep in cages, your kids.
But they like it. So
I mean, you put a pillow in there, though, right?
Of all course. Right. I'm not a savage.
a couple treats.
So user 15-2426, thank you for sending in that question. Keep sending in your questions, and we will try to get them on the air.
Thanks.
So, Danny, you and I connected. I think we connected over social media.
Yes.
And I did a little dive into your backstory. I like what you're doing now, and I want to spend a good portion of the end of this episode talking about what you do now. So why don't you give our audience a little window on how you grew up, where you grew up?
So I was born in Jersey City downtown, the old downtown Jersey City.
Margaret Hick Hospital?
No, I was born in a medical center. The old medical center,
yeah.
Before it was down there by Cole Street. Born in Jersey City Medical Center, lived between Erie and Manila downtown, which, you know, back then it was predominantly Latino, you know, very big Latin community there. You know, at a young age, my father left my mother. I believe, at the age of 2. My mother, you know, had to move to Boston. We lived in Boston for a little while. Obviously, I don't remember that. But, you know, she struggled. And
Thank God you don't remember Boston. Well,
I don't want to bring up old wounds. Did you ever get the backstory of why he left?
Nah. So, you know, I don't want to bash my father because it took a long time for me to forgive him. And just recently, I found myself forgiving him. And the reason I decided to forgive him, you know, I suffered a lot. You know, no pun intended, but it is what it is. I suffered a lot because I loved my father so much, even though he wasn't there. My mother would always remind me and say, "You are just like your dad." She goes, "You act like him, you walk like him, you talk like him." So she's like, "It's so crazy that you didn't grow up with him, but you act just like him." So, you know, I don't know the reasons why, but my father was, you know, heavy into the drug dealing business at one point. I would like to think that he would want to keep me away from that was one of the reasons why. But I also do remember vividly that there were many times that I'd be waiting for him. He'd say, "I'm coming to pick you up." He would either never show up or he would send somebody that maybe was working for him, or it would come pick me up and take me to him. You know what I mean? I didn't know that at a young age, but I never got quality time with him.
What if you got a message from your father and you started to learn that backstory? Like maybe he got sent away. Maybe he was in some trouble in order to protect his family. He removed himself from the situation. Would that make your memories a little different of him? He still wasn't there, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know. You know what, Kev? I think at that time, you're so immature, right? You don't understand that. Mm-hmm. You know, like you don't understand.
You know he's not there.
Exactly. You don't. You know, he's not there. I go to my baseball game. He's not there. You know, I'm playing. I'm graduating from eighth grade. He's not there. You know, all these special events. He's not there. So I don't know if I would, at a young age, understand that. It would still affect me. Now that I'm older, it's funny you say that. I do know his backstory, and that's why I've come to forgive him, and I've come. I get emotional about this, but I've come to realize that sometimes as a human, we have to take a step back and see what trauma other people have been through and say, well, maybe that is causing them to react the way they are with me.
But that comes with age.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It comes with age. You know, once you start growing older and you start walking up that hill a little bit, you see the whole battlefield, where when you're a child, you're down in the valley and you can only see the little skirmish going on.
Exactly.
But so you grew up in Jersey City, regular kids, sports, like what was your thing?
Yeah. Didn't grow up in Jersey City. I was there until fourth grade. Then I moved to Bayonne. For the majority, you know, I remember most of my good and bad memories in Bayonne. Played sports, basketball, baseball.
Don't say anything about Chuck Wepner.
Yeah.
The Bayonne bleeder. Yeah.
Oh, no, you don't say that. That's the exact comment that got him in trouble before. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had Jerry Cooney sitting in your seat.
He was upset.
And Mike had said it. Listen, I no longer use that name ever because Jerry Cooney's like 6'7", and he's gigantic, and he's ex-professional fighter. That has been removed from my lexicon, but Mike says it as a matter of fact. Like that's everybody knows Chuck Wepner.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, you had to see his face. Now Cooney's like he's a ball buster, but he lets it go real quick. He didn't let this one go.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh shit. Like I thought we were going to lose him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was serious. Huh?
He goes, I'm offended you said that. I'm like, this is a nickname.
I'm waiting for him to turn it around.
Yeah.
Now, the tension in this room was never so palpable.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. But Bayonne, you know, we got a lot of friends from Bayonne. I think, who did we just have in here from Bayonne? Was it Keith Shibley?
I think Shibley was from Bayonne.
And then we got Tom Smith. I mean, we know a lot of people from Bayonne, and it seems to be a nice little neighborhood to grow in.
Especially back then. Especially back then, it was super safe.
Yeah, the big park there.
Yeah, big park, Stephen R. Gregg Park. Yeah. Man, I would walk up and down Bayonne on Broadway, Kennedy Boulevard. The cops were very aggressive. But you look back now, it's like, it's kind of a good thing.
The cops in Bayonne, I swear to God, they park in trees. Because if you do over 25 miles an hour, you won't see a cop. Next thing you know, he's pulling you over.
They got to
come out of the trees, I think.
As a normal pedestrian, you see the bad things of that. But like you said, they had a task. Like they were probably proud of the safety of Bayonne.
Yeah.
I mean, you would hope they were. You'd hope this is the reason why they did what they did, because they're proud of that protection of the community.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So when you were in Bayonne, I know you're a big community-based guy now. Is that sort of how you got this community?
What molded you into your...
Yeah. Is that the community there?
I would say the trauma that I went through, the things that I went through, and then becoming law enforcement officer, and then seeing the needs of the community, working in the juvenile court, working, in the criminal court, and then working patrol and working narcotics and all these different areas. I saw the need in the community, and I saw a lot of myself in these kids and in these community members. And I noticed that I was bridging a gap when I was having these real conversations with them. And the trust was built, right? The trust and understanding once they saw, like, and then.
But you beat the statistic.
Yeah, I got lucky. Yeah,
so it's like, I think the statistic is like, I read it somewhere, it's like 70, 80% of incarcerated males come from a fatherless home.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm blessed.
A lot of these kids use it as a crutch, though.
Yes, I agree.
When I was working, we used to pull kids in and, you know, like, what are you doing? Well, you know, my parents are divorced. He's up. My parents were divorced too.
Yeah,
my parents were divorced when I was 7 or 8 years old. So 100%. Don't use that as a crutch.
There are a vast majority, like that nuclear parent family, even if the parents are divorced. But see, your father was always there.
Yep.
It's not
always a phone call away if I did anything wrong. I know that.
Right. He was always there for you. You didn't have that, and you sort of beat that statistic.
So I do want to. I do want to shout out, rest in peace, my stepfather, who was present.
I was going to ask you if he was a father figure.
Yeah, so yeah, he was. So Wilbert Estrella, he was there for me, man. I would never take that away from him. But he also had his, you know, things he was struggling with, which made him absent in a way, emotionally, right? So I did have a male figure. He did show me how to be a man. He showed me how to have character and things of that nature. But, you know, I still was lacking. And that's, you're right, you're correct. One thing I didn't want to use was like, oh, woe is me. I didn't have a dad. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to be a mess up, which I was headed down that road. But I quickly realized that that wasn't my destiny.
Well, what kind of trouble are we talking about here?
So when, you know, I got involved, I was a rapper. I'm still a rapper. I still do hip hop music, positive, of course. But, you know, at one point in time, I was really, really aggressive in chasing my dream of being a famous rapper. And in doing so, I was going through a lot. I was homeless. I left my house. I had an altercation with my mother's husband at the time, who was an alcoholic. I ended up dropping out of school, following my rap career. So when I did that, I was in the streets. I mean, I was hanging out South Orange Avenue, Kenmore, Stuyvesant, Brookdale. These are some of the most dangerous areas in Newark off of South Orange Avenue, just to build a name. Because back then you had to solicit yourself. You had to really go out there and you had to gain notoriety by being in the streets.
And street cred.
Exactly. So I was around a lot of dangerous individuals, back then, late 90s. And I seen a lot of things. I was around a lot of things. I was involved, a couple times where myself and friends got robbed. You know what I'm saying? At gunpoint, fights, different things that I was involved in, and dangerous individuals that I knew were dangerous, but I still put myself in that environment. And I was lucky and fortunate to not be intrigued by it and be like, this is what I want to do.
Was there a moment in one of those troubles that you had that sort of flipped that switch for you? Like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be like these guys.
I can't pinpoint, but there was a story where I one day was hanging out. Be honest, I was smoking weed. I was about 18 years old. We were on a cut block in Newark off of South Orange Avenue. And I was there with a group of friends, and we had just picked up, a friend of ours that came from Bermuda. I didn't know he had a large sum of money on him. There was a robbery. Gun was put to my face. These guys had bandanas over them. And that was a rude awakening for me because, I'd never had a gun put to my face. And everything, with tunnel vision, before I knew what tunnel vision was, I felt like everything was slow motion. I didn't know what was going on. So this incident
was that big.
Yeah. Yeah. The ironic thing, the weird thing was the guy had it pointed towards me, but he wasn't looking at me. He was looking at what was going on with my friend, because there was another guy robbing my friend.
That's actually worse because sympathetic trigger, as we know now, you could have got one right in the
100%.
face. 100%. Shit, I just shot Marvin in the head type of situation.
Yeah. And this is a story I really haven't told to many people. The people that do know me, that know me and were there, they would, tell you the same thing. But it did scare me. I had a friend come pick me up. I was shook, I'm not going to lie. And I just was like, what do I do now? You know what I mean?
Did you clean out your pants before your friend picked you up?
Yeah, I was wearing a diaper that day, actually.
No shame, man. There's no shame in shitting your pants with that gun barrel.
So, So,
but that's good, though. I mean, so I'm a big believer that you put in situations that are best suited for you.
Yeah.
Okay. It's your job to identify what the lesson is in that situation. That gun barrel being put in your face, did that sort of start you on a different trajectory?
Yeah. Sort of. I started going to church. Not because of that.
Thank God he didn't shoot me.
Thank God.
All right, God, I owe you one.
I had an epiphany, you know?
I owe you at least one Sunday, God.
That's a good one. But no, it was already in the works, you know? I was what they call a lukewarm Christian. I was already involved in the church. What's that?
Christmas and Easter only?
Yeah. No. I was going to church like Sundays. I was involved in the youth ministry, Hope Center Tabernacle, Jersey City. And I was in the mix. I was going to church, but I wasn't fully in. Yeah. And this kind of was like, in church, they always talk about God will send you a sign. Something will happen for God to, radically change your heart. And I took this as one of those signs, like, this never happened before. This is on a cut block. This neighborhood, you don't go to this neighborhood unless you're from that neighborhood. And I was like, what are the chances I'm there, this happens? So I kind of like took it as a sign from God. Not kind of, but I did. And that kind of changed it, started the you know, the revolution in my life.
Can I give you a theory?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, my theory is, so I was watching this guy who interviewed James Baker in prison. I don't know if you remember James Baker.
No.
He was at the PLO. It was a big ministry, and he was stealing money.
Tammy Faye Baker.
With him and Tammy Faye Baker, they were stealing money. They both went to prison. And this guy's interviewing James Baker in prison. And he asked James Baker something like, when did you stop loving Jesus? That's what he says. And James Baker says, no, you got it all wrong. I always loved Jesus. I just never feared God.
Mm.
All right. And it wasn't until he got caught that he caught God's wrath, you know? And it sounds like something like that with you, where I'm sure you love Jesus and you love, but you never feared God. You were hanging out in all sorts. And that moment, that'll put the fear of God in you.
100%.
Got that right.
Yeah. So where did you go from there when you started going to church? How what happened with your life? I'm sure, you know, you're not going to lose your love for rap.
No. I was still rapping. I was still, you know, I started doing some rap for the church, you know, positive rap, Christian rap, you know, and I gave my life to God. I was on what they call on fire for God. It got to the point where my life had like a radical, radical change, where I went from, you know, a young kid smoking weed, hanging out with the wrong crowd, being around these type of individuals, to saying, you know what? I'm going to do something positive. Now, mind you, at this time, I was a high school dropout. I was living in my friend Danny's basement, and he was a DJ. So I would stay in the basement. I would jump house to house. My clothes was in a garbage bag, literally. And I was lost. I was like, what am I going to do? You know, I was 20 years old. So I end up going to get my GED. I'm going to church, right, and doing all the right things. I get my GED at the Adult Education Center in Jersey City. And after that, the whole, you know, my whole life changed. And that's why I tell everybody I know God is real. Because the change that my mother tells me this all the time, you know, the generational curse was broke. It's funny you mentioned that, you know, I believe in divine intervention. That was a great question. But my mother says the generational curse was broken with you, because my father's side of the family, like drug abuse, you know, I'm talking about diseases, all different types of things that have took people down. And my mother's like, wow, you just completely on the other. I'm the only cop in my family. You know what I mean?
Well, I actually say generational curses in the opening, which I pre-recorded. Yeah. And I didn't make that up. I actually stole it from another Puerto Rican. I did. Benny Love.
Shout to Benny Love, man. So
Benny Love, you know, breaking the chains, breaking generational curses. Mm-hmm. And when he said that to me, it hit me so hard, because I'd spend my whole life trying to break the generational curses. And he just defined it. That's all he did, was, you know, tell me what the definition of it was. And the breaking those generational curses, God, it's essential for you doing anything great in this world. Even if you're destined for it, unless you break that, you're going nowhere.
Yes.
Well, you know what it is too? It takes hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people don't want to work hard. They're stuck in that rut. You know, like we say with, you know, post-traumatic stress, you get so comfortable in that hole, you don't feel like getting out.
Mm-hmm.
So people, and like you said, it's generational. You know, kids see their parents aren't working, so they're like, oh, I don't have to work either.
I mean, look back to your hip-hop career. Okay, look back to that. Being where you were on that kid on the street corner, trying to become a famous rapper, rather than just to be a rapper that's good and heard and doing what is right, you're looking at, oh, I just want to be that. I don't care. I don't want to go through all the steps. I just want to do that. But it takes a lot of hard work to get there. It takes a lot of self-realization to get there, and a lot of courage. You're starting to build that courage up now with your newfound life that you started to lead. You notice all these things getting better. You get your GED, start getting your life in order. You got you're in the church all the time. What's next for you? Now you're starting to think about your life and your career.
Yeah. So once again, God, man, I go to, you know, I get my GED. When I go in, the teacher, Mr. Sharp, never forget this day. He goes, all right, guys, it's going to take about 10 months for you guys to get your GED. I was deflated. I'm like, oh my God, 10 months coming here. Right?
I just want to go in and sign a paper.
Exactly. Thank you. Like, I thought this was just like an ASVAB. Take a quick test. I'm in, right? So it was more like deflated. But I put my belief in God. At this time, I was like, you know, completely in ministry. And I said, you know what, God, I'm going to believe in you. And then a miracle happened. A couple weeks later, He comes back. He said, guys, I got good news. You could take a practice test. If you pass the practice test, you're eligible for the GED. I passed it. I got my GED within 3 months.
Crazy.
It's insane. And then from there, I just get my, I go and I apply for Verizon when they started putting in the fiber cable.
The Fios lines.
Yeah, the Fios. Yeah. So it's like, how could you not believe in divine intervention? So that happens. I go to an open house that they were having. They were having tests in like hotels. So I take the test. I pass. I get hired as a splicer.
The key component to any law enforcement officer being the best version of themselves is through education. Sherry Alsop is a leader in providing that education to police agencies, preparing them for the all too frequent dealings with sexual assault victims.
You've seen Sherry on episode 169 of the Suffering Podcast. She survived incest and almost daily sexual assault, so she comes from a place of experience and true understanding.
Sherry has the intelligence, commitment, and compassion to open the eyes of those on the front lines, while providing the tools to effectively deal with a difficult situation. Sherry's instruction comes from experience and multiple certifications.
Training with Sherry will offer on-site training, customized schedules, specialized instruction, tailored from a victim's perspective.
You are going to hear Sherry's heart-wrenching but inspiring survivor story. Learn proprietary trauma-informed training techniques. Uncovered victim-centered interview methods while earning continuing education credits according to your state guidelines. To be the best, you must learn from the best. Let Sherry also guide you through the delicate cases of sexual assault from a victim's point of view.
Be a source of comfort to those victims affected by these traumatic experiences while producing a solid investigation and uncovering details that often go unnoticed.
To find out more or to contact Sherry Alsop, go to SherryAlsop.com. That's SherryAlsop.com.
The age of 21, I'm making good money. Now I'm like on my feet. It's incredible. And then in the midst of that, the police test comes out and, you know, somebody tells me, hey, you know, hey, Dano, they used to call me Dano. Dano, man, you probably be a good cop, man. Take the test. I take the test and fast forward 18 years ago, you know, I got on a job with the sheriff's office.
So, you know, you're on a street corner with some kids who are futureless, right? Yep. You know who I'm talking about, too. Mm-hmm. I don't have to mention any name. They're futureless. And you're a bright kid and you're trying to play a role as one of them. And to some extent you are, because they're your friends.
Yeah.
But you're no dummy. Like you're passing all these, you see what's happening, right? Your intelligence is starting to show through. You're passing the GED in under the time. You're getting hired right away. All these good things are happening. You get the police test, you take your police test. I mean, when you took the police test, was it like this is my way of impacting, or was it just a job for you?
It was literally job security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I took the job. You know, I was told, hey, man, pension, 25 years, full benefits at that time.
Yeah.
Full medical, right? Yeah. You know, and that's the reason. And at the time, I was, you know, having my first child, you know. So it was like, at that point, it was like, I was thinking like, okay, I want to be that good father. I want to provide. And, you know, I want to have a career that's respectable, you know. And that's what I was thinking at the time.
Now, once you got into that job, what changed? Something changed in you. You saw something, you did something.
Yeah.
Something got into you.
I was a complete fuck up. Right?
I was going to say that, but yeah, you're a lot bigger than I am.
Nah. So in the beginning, you know, and I say that with no excuses because I hate, oh, you know, it's because it is. And I learned that through reading and researching and really looking deep inside myself, like using excuses to say, well, it's because it is. No. Yeah. But I had no guidance when I got on a job. You have an FTO. You have somebody that says, all right. But, you know, old school mentality, a lot of older guys.
The dinosaurs.
Yes. They're like, oh, God, this kid, just keep your head low. This job sucks. And it was very toxic. So I never had a mentor to say, hey, Danny, I was full of piss and vinegar getting on the job. I want to get out there. I want to make a difference. Squared away. You know, at this time, I was 185 pounds, great shape. And I'm like, I want to do the job. I made a lot of mistakes. No criminal mistakes, obviously, but it was a lot of mistakes of trying to do too much, right? And not being effective and not having a proper education and training within law enforcement. So that's how I started messing up. And
because you wanted, you thought the job was one thing.
Yeah.
Right? You thought that this was the job. I don't know what year. What do you think, Mike? What year does the job start changing and you start seeing what the job really is?
I was going to say when you get the top pay, probably.
Yeah. That's fair. That's a fair amount.
Start getting a lot happier.
Yeah, that's right. Not today. Back then, top pay was like 4 or 5 steps.
Yeah. I started, I went through all those trials and tribulations. It started building Bookham, right? I was going through the refining process. So we're like diamonds. And where do diamonds come from? They come from some of the most treacherous grounds, caves, dark places, right? They don't come out shining. We can't just go buy them.
There's no diamond trees.
Exactly. So I was being refined. I was getting cut. I was going through the fire to become Bookham and the Bridges Project that I am today. And through those learning experiences, I'm able to help other cops. I'm able to relate to cops that may be making those mistakes. And also the kids in the community. I made those mistakes as well, so I could relate to you. So that's what Bridges is building a bridge off of understanding, commonality, and trust. You know what I'm saying?
I'm sure you had some difficult calls. Where did you get on first? I don't even think.
Hudson County Sheriff's. I've been there my whole career.
One job, one place.
Yeah.
Unlike some people who transferred.
I started up.
I tried to transfer, but it didn't work out for me. But that
Of the people from Hudson tried to transfer to Bergen.
A lot more money. 100%.
That's where I started. Bergen County Sheriff's Office.
You got to go to Hoboken every once in a while.
Yeah.
And go down by the water.
Water.
But you probably had some. So what were you assigned to when you first got on?
When I first got on, I was in court division, court bureau. I was in. It was all over, jumping around. And then the sheriff, under Sheriff Shalari, came up to me at the time. He's like, "Hey, kid, I think you'd be good for patrol. We're going to send you to patrol." Be quite honest, patrol was terrible at the time, right? I'm not bad-mouthing the department, but everybody knows. At that time, here's your keys. Go park. Don't say a word. Don't stop cars. Don't do nothing. Just be present. And
sit in the park.
Exactly. And that's what it was. And I was 23 years old. I was, in good shape. I wanted to work. And, it just kind of like wasn't working out for me. And I was miserable. Got sent back to the building. And then I worked criminal, family, landlord, tenant, all over the place for a while till I went to narcotics for the prosecutor's office. And shout to Captain Pacheco. He's retired now. He's the first one to give me an opportunity. He saw me at an event. And he goes, "Hey, man, I think you'd be great for narcotics. We're going to get you over." And I worked there for about 2 years. And then came back and went back to patrol. But I tried to leave for the money reasons. I tried to leave for, I want to make a better life. But I'm going to tell you this. Everything happens for a reason. I wasn't able to leave, for reasons I don't want to really mention, right? Nothing crazy, but the opportunity wasn't presented to me. And I believe firmly today, if I were to be somewhere else, I wouldn't be able to do what I do now. It's absolutely crazy. You get what I'm saying? Some departments might try to handcuff me, but it's just, I have a liberty and a freedom and I'm blessed.
Or you might find an opportunity inside that department that sort of drives you away from what you're
exactly.
What you're doing. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
Like you might get put into a homicide investigation, which is a great gig, but
you're called out all hours of the night.
Correct. You're not able to do. And that also could have taken away from time from your children and being that father that you always wanted to be. Now, you said you had gotten married before you were a cop.
Yes.
Yes. So when you get this crazy idea, because it sounds like you're making good money in Verizon, "Hey, hon, I'm going to go be a cop." What was your wife's reaction?
She was like, "Good, go get more money." She's like, "We need it."
So you married
at the time. So this is my first marriage. I'm married for a second time. Okay. I made the same mistake twice. Yeah. I made the same mistake twice. Yeah.
No,
I'm joking, baby. I tell my
wife now, I'm taking the till death do us part a little bit more serious this time.
Yeah.
I got a shovel in the back and a 3-foot hole because I'm not digging holes hard.
Yeah.
I'll stay out of this conversation.
Yeah. So
every work for me.
So how do you know he's a good cop? Well, he's probably got some addictive problem and he's been married at least twice.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
He's got an ex somewhere.
Yeah. So she was all for it. She was ready to go.
Yeah, she was all for it. Super supportive. And I was fortunate, man, to get hired. And this is back when, it was super competitive. I was like I had like a 96 score and I was like number 76. Yeah. It was like super competitive.
It got to a point where if you didn't get like a 99, you weren't even considered.
Especially for Bayonne. Yeah. I lived in Bayonne at the time. It was like 99. don't even look if you're, you know, anywhere below a 98 with veteran status. Yeah. You know?
And you weren't veteran status.
No, no veteran status. No.
Well, so
he's a veteran on the street, but not military.
So my math is off. So you got what, 2006?
Yeah, 2006. Yeah,
2006.
I'm in my 18th year.
Yeah, but so I'm like, veteran status is a big thing. It actually, veteran status doesn't really mean much anymore because they're all vets coming out because of the war. But I think it's going to, like, when I got on, there wasn't a whole lot of vets because we weren't in anything active. Now it's a little bit different. There's just vet after vet. So unless you're a vet, it's going to be real tough to get the job. But while you're, do you mind if I ask you about your first marriage?
No, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
So you get married, again, this fits into my statistic thing.
Hey, it's
I got this weird statistic thing in my head. Those people who got married before they were a cop have a higher rate of divorce than those that got married after they became a cop. Because the woman kind of knows what she's getting involved with. Because this job changes you.
It does. 100%. 100%.
What do you think the way you changed? I'm not blaming one party or the other, but there's something in you that changed. It's natural that this job changes you. So if you could pinpoint it.
Oh, man. You know, to be honest, I became somewhat more attractive to women out there.
Chicks dig uniforms.
You know, badge bunnies. No disrespect to the females out there. They like
hope there's different blue crotch.
So that was tough for me. You know, dealing with that, dealing with the temptation, also wanting to hang out with the fellas and go out and go drinking, go hang out, and just be around the fellas.
Hang out in the bar after the shift.
Exactly. Be around, you know, trying to fit in, you know, just trying to be part of that brotherhood. And that really affected what was going on at home, and trying to be a Christian. So it really it counterproductive for me at the time.
It's a tough thing when you're trying to balance that life, because you don't really know how to balance it. You're just doing the best you can.
Yeah.
It happens more times than not. You know,
got that right.
Well, unfortunately happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So you're, when did you get married for the second time?
My wife, babe, don't be upset, but I think it's 13 years now. 13 years ago, we got married. So I was 29.
Bro, you got enough tattoos. You get a tattoo right on your arm right there. So you never forget.
Actually, it makes 13 years, April 29th.
Okay.
So she'll be happy. I knew the date.
So your next everything. Look at that.
Yeah. Your next stop is to the tattoo artist. You're going to get a tattoo right here. It's like, how long have we been married? Okay, we're good.
Gotcha.
We're good. So you get into, when did you start seeing the community aspect of police work?
Ironic as it may seem, it was in the courthouse. Working the criminal division. Shout to Judge D. Pascal, legendary. He's the GOAT, you know what I mean? Used to be the head prosecutor for the Hudson County, for the prosecutor's office. But anyway, I worked alongside him. I saw so many cases, homicide, young kids coming in, gangs. And what I would do is, my approach was different, right? So I had an epiphany one day, or God spoke to me clearly, and I was depressed. I was really in a dark place because I had certain individuals, you know, on the job that were making my job more difficult.
Yeah.
They didn't understand me. We didn't, you know, and they were in positions of authority that I couldn't control. And I was bounced around, but then I was eventually put here. And when I was put here, God spoke to me and said, shine wherever I put you. Just shine. So what I did was, I just started having conversations with every inmate I came across, and being myself.
Wealth of knowledge.
Oh my God. It's like
wealth of knowledge.
Unbelievable. I would walk in the bullpen. You know, we would keep them in a holding area. There'd be up to 20, whatever, in one. And I felt so good when I would walk in there and they would be like, oh, Rivera, what's up, man? Everybody. Because every individual that I encountered, I made sure that I had a positive interaction. No matter how bad their day was, no matter how bad my day was, I made sure that I spoke to them like a human being. I didn't mistreat them. I explained everything to them. Listen, we turn around for me, please, sir. You know, step away, step out of the yellow box. I have to handcuff you. I would explain everything. I would give them certain privileges. You want to say hi to your mom. You want to, because sometimes the mothers can't make it, because whatever, to go see them. And I would give them common courtesy as a human being and show love and respect. And through that, I was doing community work. Next thing I knew, by the grace of God, man, I have, you know, kids coming to, hey, what's up, man? Yo, you know, you're awesome. Thank you for, you know, But I will tell a story. There was a kid in Jersey City who, I don't remember exactly when this happened, but a Jersey City cop was doing surveillance on a house, right? There was a real bad drug problem in a specific area. This kid was doing surveillance for the drug, for the team, for the, you know, for the drug trafficking ring that was over there. But there was a cop that was doing surveillance, and this kid comes up to the car and has a gun. He's looking like, what's this car doing here? The cop has to hide in the back seat. And eventually there's a shooting that occurs. The kid loses his eyesight. Okay. The kid gets shot in the head. He lives, but loses his eyesight. This kid's trial is in my court. And I was empathetic for the mother because he got sentenced to jail. And I showed my empathy towards the mother. Believe it or not, there was some, you know, some cops that were like,
why would you do that?
Why would you be nice to the mom? I'm like, dude, she doesn't control his actions. She could teach him all the best things, give him as much value and provide the best setting for him. Just because of the demographic doesn't mean she's a bad person. And that to me bothered me because I said, when I took the job and I got interviewed, they asked me, why do I want to become a cop? And one of the reasons was I want to be a role model. I want to be somebody that's respected in my community. And I feel like we, you know, a lot of times in law enforcement, we walk away from that. Nobody walks into a job interview and says, well, I want to be an asshole and I want to treat people with disrespect and talk down on people. No one would get hired. Right. So
nowadays,
you know,
nowadays they might.
Yeah. Well, you know, but you know, that's where it really started. And then, you know,
and you were starting to become a respected officer. Hey, listen, if you do get popped, you want to get in Officer Rivera's court
because yes.
he's a good guy.
Yes.
He'll
yes.
treat you with respect. You know, he'll do his job, but he'll treat you with respect. So you start building that brand. Like yes. that's what you're doing. You're branding yourself as a police officer, as a law enforcement officer, and it'll probably serve you well because you'll have less incidents in your courtroom.
Exactly.
People will treat you with respect. Your judge is going to be happy with you, and you know, like, hey, listen, don't take this guy. Don't disrespect this guy. Does a good job here, and that's all you want. Shine wherever you are, just like you said.
Yeah. I tell you real quick, we've had trials with two different gangs in the courtroom. And just to piggyback off what you said, metal detectors set up. We know they hate each other. One of their homies just got killed by the opposing gang. We know that they're going there with bad intentions. And I would meet with them by myself outside of not saying I'm a big, tough guy. But I would say, guys, I know what the deal is. I know what's this. I know what's that. Show me love and respect. Respect what I'm doing here. Everything will be cool. By the grace of God, like you said, no incidents in the courtroom. People would have outbursts. I would never embarrass anybody. Hey, yo, shut your mouth. I'd walk over to them like a man and I'd make eye contact and say, hey, man, I'm doing my job. There's cameras here. If I don't do my job, I'm going to get in trouble. Can you do me a solid and just calm down? I understand.
You said it all the time, you know, I don't come to your job and cause problems.
Exactly.
But you used to see this with the influx of people going into Pennsylvania. Houses were cheaper, right?
Yeah.
So you have a lot of good families. And this kind of hit me when you said you respect the mother. You have a lot of good families in the inner city who don't want their kids to be tied up into the gang stuff and the problems and stuff. Some of them got out when it was too late. They get their houses in Pennsylvania, and what happens in certain parts of Pennsylvania become really bad because those kids bring the crap over to there. But all it is in its heart is the parents trying to give their kids a better life.
But see, what happens, like you said, sometimes it works in reverse because now the parents are still working in New Jersey.
Yeah.
So all these gangs would befriend all these people that moved up from New Jersey because they know they have an open house all day.
Exactly. So they just sort of moved. Yep. They relocated the headquarters of their gang. And it always broke me. But how many times have you come across families who, you know, you'll see somebody come in, they got four different kids and no carrier, their diapers are dirty, their clothes are dirty. And you look at these poor kids and you're like, man, you don't even have a chance.
You don't have a chance in hell.
You got two strikes against you and you're going to have to live this way. It breaks your heart. But so how do you change something like that? That's the big question. You know, you're doing community-based police work without doing community-based police work. And you see these tragic situations and you see the train rolling down the tracks and you know it's going to hit something and derail. How do you step in and stop it?
You can't stop the train. but you could let them know that you're there. You know, you could, you know, you plant seeds. You know, the old saying, plant a seed, man. It started with me in the drug abuse resistance education program, DARE program in Bayonne. You know, when I was a kid, I still remember the cop that would come to our school, right? And, you know, and I still remember him being such a pleasant individual. So, you know, you give hope. The best way to give hope is by giving them your time, going back to love. Very simple in law enforcement. And I always say this to, and especially now I'm going to say this to encourage all my brothers and sisters in law enforcement out there. Everybody admires all the specialized units, right? Emergency services, SWAT, you know, narcotics, homicide. They're all wonderful units, amazing individuals. But, you know, the recon, I feel like, is community-based. When you, what you do is when you're out there, boots to the ground, building his relationship with these community members, and you know them by first name basis, and you know, guess what? You become a breath of fresh air.
And it deters crime doing
yes!
it.
Yes. And you get information, right?
But they there's might- something about you, and I'm going to tell you what it is. So my experience with community policing officers, they're not like you. The majority of them. They're not like you. They are... what do we used to call them? House mouses?
House mouses.
House, and I'm not
chief's pet.
I'm not downing them because they do a valuable job, but you're coming into a job where street smarts plays a big role in community policing. It's not the guy who's best at paperwork. It's not the guy who's good at the computer programs. It's the guy that's willing to go out there and mix it up with the community. So that's what's different. That's what I'm saying right now. You're willing to go mix it up with a community, but you're also coming from a place of experience. You've been there. You were that kid. You could easily have turned out to be that adult who's incarcerated for X amount of years. So I don't know if that's the way that it is, but that's what I'm saying.
You nailed it, man. You nailed it.
See, you know, another thing, like you were saying before, you know, being part of that community, I was always taught that the police are an extension of your parents. Right. So when you're out there in uniform and you're doing this community policing and you're doing this good work and you're talking to these kids about it, it's almost like being a father figure to these kids, you know, and you get their respect that way. You know, I used to pull the police car over all the time, play basketball to kids, you know, throw football around with them, you know, part of that community.
Till some eighth grader dunks on you.
That only happened three times.
I got dunked on. I got dunked on, so and it went viral.
One of the greatest videos I ever saw was a bunch of kids are out playing streetball. Cop car rolls up. Shaq pops out.
I saw that.
Shaq pops out.
He loves law enforcement.
Yeah, he does. He's the best.
Super. He got deputized, I think.
Yeah, absolute best. Yeah. And gets out and plays ball. The cops bring Shaq there. And I'm thinking to myself, damn, man, that's what it's all about right there. That's what it's all about, because those kids will never forget the time the police brought Shaq to go play basketball with.
Exactly. And you become a breath of fresh air. When you're a breath of fresh air, you show up on scene, and we all know, we've been around guys that they show up and you're like, shit, is it going to get worse?
Yep.
I got this guy or this girl's a liability. Or when they show up, you're like, I'm in great hands. Kevin's here. These guys are here. I feel good.
But there is one downside to the way you police work. You do your police work. There's a downside.
Yeah.
So when something does pop off, when something does happen where you have to maybe lock up somebody, it almost feels like a lost child, where you actually have to go do your job and lock somebody up or do something that you don't want to do. Or if you stand over a dead body of a kid that you knew, you're like, I lost one. I lost one. And that's got to weigh on you because you're not hardened. You know, you fought hard against not being hardened by the system.
Yeah.
You know, that's got to bother you. Does it ever get to you?
Yeah. Shout to Lynette DiNardo. She's a school psychologist. She's one of the first people to give me an opportunity in the schools with the Bridges Project. And a group of those kids are, you know, they had major behavioral issues. A lot of things. Parents killed by gun violence. You know, maybe they don't have their parents. And some of them I mentored, and some of them, you know, they're not in contact with me anymore. They got locked up, or, you know, it's just the nature of the beast. I can't control that. I can control what I do and what's in my heart I could control. And if I could save one, you save the dynamic of the world, right? Everybody makes up a percentage of the globe. If you change one, you change the percentage of positive to negative. Am I right? No matter how minute it is, but if I change one, so you know, it's built off my reward comes later. My reward isn't right now. My reward is later when I'm retired, walking through ShopRite with my family, and a cop comes up to me or a kid comes up to me who's now a man or a girl, right? And they come up to me and they say, hey, Booker, man, you don't remember me? That's my reward.
Yeah.
When you came talk to me.
When you don't remember the amount that you saved.
Exactly.
That's actually the greatest thing ever.
Exactly.
Well, you never know how many you save. You just know how many you lost.
Exactly. You know, exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, you're passionate. I'm passionate about it. And I want to save all of them. You know, we want to save all of them. You know, we want to, you know, I have a team, man. You know, I have a team that is passionate about what we do. And we want to save all of them. But we're also aware that, you know, we can't save all of them.
How did this transition into the, I want to get into the Bridges Project. I want to know how this theory of yours, this lifestyle, this way of policing transition into the Bridges Project.
Ironic as it may seem, shout to Johnny. Johnny was locked up for a long time. Good friend of mine. He's from the projects. He's from Booker T Projects, one of the most dangerous projects in Jersey City. They call it Bullet Town. And he comes out of jail.
Which is ironic because Booker T Washington was one of the most bright.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable. And he was one of the few Latinos, Puerto Ricans, that lived in the projects, grew up, born, raised, violence, you know. So anyway, we were good friends. We used to work together. So we grew up. So when he comes out of jail, I'm a cop. And it never changed our relationship. Obviously, at the time, he was still involved in some negativity. I couldn't be around him. But there was a mutual respect, right? It wasn't like, I never knew you. It was more like, I can't be around you.
I can't talk to you now because.
Exactly. Yeah. We would see each other, mutual respect. Can't go have a beer with you. But hey, what's up, man? How you been? How's the family? But he's the one that pulled me aside one day and told me, bro, you're the bridge, man. You're the bridge between the hood and cops. He's like, we need you. He's like, you're the bridge. And I was like, wow, the Bridges Project. So it's ironic that a community member that was, you know, formerly incarcerated, now changed his life. Shout to him and his family. Has a beautiful family. He's doing positive things. He's the one that actually put the thought in my head. And that's when it started about 9 years ago. And, you know, now it correlates over to my job because I consider myself a bridge, not only for the community, but for cops. I get so many messages from cops.
Well, bridges go both ways.
Exactly. Exactly. But I get calls from cops, DMs, messages. Yo, man, how do you do what you do? My department won't let me do that. Oh, how could you rap? And I'm talking about Dallas, Alabama. I've had cops reach out to me who are depressed and they feel comfortable coming to me. And to me, it's just a blessing that God is using me in this form and fashion through the Bridges Project.
He's giving you a voice. So the Bridges Project.
And a platform.
Explain to us what the Bridges Project does. Besides, we know you're the bridge between the community and the police and the police and the community. But tell me what the Bridges Project does.
We are a mentorship/leadership program. Our niche is within the school systems, predominantly kids that are at risk youth. And we are considered a tier 2 intervention program. So what we do is we go into schools and we mentor kids in a school setting, right? In a group setting on perseverance, goals, resilience, you know, community. We have a full blown curriculum. So the Bridges Project, what we want to do is not only let them know that, you know, not all cops are bad, but we want to show them that you can utilize your gifts and talents, like be a rapper and be a positive rapper. You could still be a cop and be a rapper. Why not? You could still be a doctor and be a rapper. And there is a doctor that I follow that she's a rapper,
but not only a rapper.
There you go. You know? Yeah. What's wrong with that? But like I said, utilize your gifts and your talents. And what we want to do is, you use the term, give them a voice. You said it. Give them a voice. A lot of these kids, they don't like cops because they think we're robots. You don't like rap. So when I show up, when my team shows up, we show up and we meet them right where they are. You like rap? We like rap. You like Jordans? We like Jordans. And it's not something that I made up. It's something that was part of my culture growing up. It's part of my very fabric. So, you know, that's what the Bridges Project is. And you said it. You said it clearly. When I talk to the kids, I say, how are bridges built? Can it be built by one person? No. Two ends have to meet. And where is it built over? It's normally built over treacherous waters or treacherous lands, right? So that's what we do. And then once that bridge is built, we could travel The bridge doesn't say you're white, you're black, you're Latino, you're Asian, you can't come across this bridge. The bridge doesn't say this is your past, this is your present, this is your future. You can't. No, the bridge is open to everybody, but it just takes us to understand each other.
So being white police officers, we run into this.
You're white? No way. I thought you were Puerto Rican.
I very light skinned Puerto Rican.
You have a nice tan. You have a nice tan.
There's only two of us in here.
Andy is our
Andy. Andy looks like Adrian Brody. So,
God,
but
is that you?
But that's You're a Puerto big. That's a big block. That's a big block because people will look at me and they'll be like, "You don't know anything about the way I grew up." I'm like, "No, motherfucker, I grew up in. I come from the city. Trust me, I'm good." But people don't understand that. They're going to look at me one way and they're going to judge me in much the same way that certain cops are going to look at them and judge them right away before they know.
Yes.
So that bridge does travel both ways when it comes to that.
Yes.
But it's always a roadblock with white officers. They could want to do exactly what you do. But they have to overcome so much in order to get to that.
They do. I agree.
Absolutely.
But I would just say this. White officers doing this is even greater than me doing it. Because the stigma on white officers and minorities is so bad that if they were, right, to say a guy like you, be out there, loved by your community, like shout to Tommy Norman in North Little Rock, Arkansas. He's a legend. I don't know if you know about him, Tommy Norman.
No.
He's the pioneer of community policing. Look him up when you get a chance. But anyway, they start to love you so much and they say, well, wait a minute. I know some white cops that are cool as hell, man. You know, that's not true what I see on the internet. And that's, you know,
when you start seeing one thing that's not true, the dominoes start to fall.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, the best compliment as a cop, I forgot. It's kind of a backhanded compliment. I was dealing with this one who was black kid and I was dealing with him so much. And I always treated him with respect. I always treated him very kindly. And he goes, you know what? You got the N-word pass. And I said, well, I'll tell you what.
No, thanks.
That's a trick.
I'm not going to say it because in the much the same way that I don't refer to a female as the B-word.
Because I don't think
that's a proper term for anybody.
Yeah.
It was a backhanded compliment. And from the place where he was giving it to me, it was a big show of respect by
100%.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, 100%.
It's like, don't worry, I'm good. I'll just keep saying it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thanks, brother, but I got you. I'm fine.
Pass on that.
Yeah, I was singing this Wu-Tang song the other day, and I N-word through the whole thing.
I'm riding this lane by myself. I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the Bridges Project's had some successes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're still growing. Can I shout my team out?
Absolutely.
Yeah, shout out to, you know, I mentioned her before, school psychologist Lynette DiNardo, Dr. Pia Moore, my cousin who's the operations director, Derek Machado. Shout to Nelson Rivera, Lighthouse Films. Shout to Alex Ralph, who also does some visual content for us. And shout to my wife, man. She's in charge of all the clerical stuff and helping us out. And the team is so important. And I realized that, you know, just a couple years ago, how important your team is. And, you know, going back to God, and I know I keep mentioning it, but my team was given to me by God. It's just me and different people and believing in each other because it's not me. It's a whole team and believing in each other. And everybody has different skills, you know, so.
Like you said, one man can't build a bridge.
No, exactly. Exactly. So I'm just so blessed to have these people in my life.
And, where do you hope to take it?
My dream is to have this nationally known. In regards to having liaison, having representatives who are law enforcement officers who are just being themselves and being in the community and are able to mentor kids within their community in a school setting, right? And I, you know, go back to what you said. It's not an office, you know, it's not somebody that's in an office giving out stickers and hats on National Night Out.
Yeah.
It has to be consistent. It has to be throughout the year. They have to know you. It has to be consistent and you have to continue to be tangible to these kids and to the community, not only kids, to everybody. And I promise you that will induce change. Crime will always be there. We're never going to stop crime. It's like, I'm not here, you know, saying, oh my God, we're going to stop crime and everything. But what we want to do is change the trajectory on how people feel about law enforcement and also give them hope that, yeah, you can make it out of this environment.
You know, I think the thing that is most important is that, you know, you got to be real.
There you go.
You got
to
be
real. There you go. Be yourself.
Exactly.
Be yourself.
I would venture to say that if, let's, you know, God forbid that you get hurt or something, and you can't be on the community for a certain amount of time, you're laid up or whatever, your absence will be felt on the street. And that's how you know you did your job.
Yes.
You know, when they don't see you there, like, uh-oh, hey, let me go check on Officer Rivera.
Man.
Yeah, that's what you want to do. So where can we find the Bridges Project?
Oh, you can find the Bridges Project on Instagram and Facebook. On Instagram, it's Bookem. That's B-O-O-K-E-M as in Mary _ Bridges. And on Facebook, it's Bookem Bridges. And also you could go to the website, www.thebridgesproject.org. You can also email me at theprojectbridges @gmail.com. If you have any questions.
Any other plugs you want to throw out?
No, I want to thank you guys, man. I want to thank the Suffering Podcast. I know, you know, I really do want to give you your flowers. I know I did it off the record, but you guys compliment each other very well. I'm grateful for the opportunity because I know this is a little outside of, you know, what you guys would normally do, and getting me in here.
Not really.
I appreciate it.
A guy coming from the streets.
I appreciate it.
Through that suffering and becoming a cop and you know, the Bridges Project and everything.
Yeah,
well, one thing you did say, you know, you want to take this nationwide. I hate to deflate you, but you're not getting it from this show.
don't downplay yourself. Let me tell you. Don't downplay yourself, because
we may get you to Bayonne.
Maybe
parts of New York. That's about it.
Hoboken.
I got a lot of friends in Hoboken.
We got Hoboken.
Shout the Hoboken, man. I got a lot of good friends.
Miles Square.
But you're knuckle dragging through the process. You're getting one person at a time, and you're saving that one person.
We used to do one person at it, one kid at a time, but. To be quite honest, it's hard. I have a family. I have a job. I have a career. You know, there's so much going on. My kids are important, obviously. So what we have to do, what we did is we revamped the Bridges Project, and now we're doing it group settings. What's the best place? Schools, programs, and you know, different elements where there's a group of kids that need our resources.
You're also starting to look beyond the badge.
Yes.
You're in your 18th year.
Yeah.
You're hitting the twilight. You're starting to, the sun's starting to set on your career, and all you're doing is building a legacy. So when your career ends, Bridges Project can move on.
Absolutely. Hopefully, God willing.
So Danny, we're coming to the end of this thing here. And you know, I love the place you came from, and I love how you view police work now. And it wasn't always that way in police work.
No.
And your life wasn't always this way. I'm sure there were some dark days when you were a little kid that felt very hopeless. What am I going to do? Where's my future? And you've gone through an enormous amount of suffering to get to where you are today. But I guarantee it's taught you something. So why don't you tell us what your suffering has taught you?
My suffering has taught me how to be resilient, how to lean on God, and how to, you know, use my trauma to help others out of the trauma, out of their trauma. You know, it's just taught me how to be a better father. You know, I'm able to, you know, love on my daughters because of what I went through, and to not allow them to go through the suffering that I went through.
And you're lighting that torch for the next one coming up the ladder.
Yeah, exactly. But you're building generations.
Thank you.
Danny, thank you so much for coming in tonight. And this is a good one. This is a real good one.
Thank you, sir.
It's a feel good story.
Yeah, it is.
We don't have to decompress on the way.
No, this is a good one. But you've been in here, so now you are part of our family, and you must keep us abreast of everything that the Bridges Project is doing, because we'll throw it out there. Listen, when we believe in something, your family.
Thank you, man.
We're all on your team.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. And thank you for the opportunity, guys.
Hey, thank you for what you're doing.
Appreciate you.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Your stuff needs to be highlighted.
Thank you, man.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of a Mentor with Danny Bookem Rivera. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned. Parents need to be there. Moments are put in front of us to open our eyes. Police work changes you. Shine wherever you are. Planting seeds now will bear fruit in the future. But most importantly, it's be a bridge. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast. Don't forget to go to 234 Franklin Avenue. Visit Gus over at Cubita Cafe. He's got the most wonderful food over there. He takes care of us here. And I'm a regular there now because the food doesn't hurt my stomach, because Gus really cares about what he's cooking over there. Go to popple.com, put in the code TSP20 for your digital business card, get your 20% discount. Follow us on all social media. That's Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, whatever.
OnlyFans.
Follow Mike at Mike_Filets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. We'll see you on the next episode.